So the question was asked, why must we keep a minhag? Ilan asked, okay? And Ilan asked, explain to me, please. Alon, you didn't tell me you switched it to Ilan? No. Alon, okay, I'm sorry. My age. What? Because I have no excuse, you're saying. Okay. Coming back to, so how do I know when I learn if something is a minhag, a din de rabbanan, halacha? So I guess we have to start with yours first, even though I was going to start with Gilad's first, yeah?
Just add another point to this question. How do I know it's counsel that a rabbi is giving, like maybe a medical counsel?
So that's a separate question. Remind me, Bezat Shem, we'll get to that. Okay, so when we learn the Gemara, when we learn the sources, we're looking. That's part of what we're looking to define. And that's why learning Gemara gives me a better understanding of halacha than learning a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Did you wonder why we have all those volumes up there? Why don't we just open a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch and figure it all out? And the answer is, because you can't know it from a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. What the Gemara does is the Gemara works to figure out, where did this come from? Nachmanides, the Ramban, in his commentary on the Rambam's work, the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvot, in the intro to the Sefer HaMitzvot, the Rambam writes the rules of how he's going to count the 613 biblical laws. So Ramban over there in his commentary says you should know most of what the Gemara is busy doing is working backwards. The Gemara is taking the Judaism we know and saying, where did this come from? Is the source for this biblical, rabbinic. The Gemara is taking the Mishnah, the Gemara is taking the Brayta, and the Gemara is saying, okay, I see the law. Now explain to me, where did this come from? And the Gemara is working backwards to derive. The Gemara does not work forwards. The Gemara doesn't posit a question and say, Ilan Ramon, Zichrono Livracha, will land on the moon. What day does he keep Shabbos on? Well, let's look at the Psukim and figure out what the halacha will be on that. You almost don't find that in the Gemara. What the Gemara does is the Gemara starts with the end point and then works backwards. It says, okay, I have this halacha in the Mishnah. Where did it come from? So the Gemara is working to figure out the sources. That's most of what the Gemara does, says Ramban. Okay? So when we learn Gemara, we're working out, and it's not always so easy, we're working out what the sources are for the laws quoted in the Mishnah and in the Gemara and the Talmud. And when we work that out, as we learn, we should be defining for ourselves, did the Gemara just tell me a derivation, and that would make it Doraita, biblical? Did the Gemara give me an asmachta? The Gemara really quoted a pasuk. But that pasuk doesn't obligate the concept, it indicates the concept. So sometimes the Gemara will quote you pasukim that are indicative, or as we call it, asmachta, the Gemara calls it. The concept has something to lean on in Torah, but it's not a derivation. So then I can have something that the Talmud tells me, and the Talmud quotes a pasuk. But if I don't pay close enough attention, I'm going to miss it. That's still not Torah, that's still not biblical. So that we pay attention as we learn. What about minhag? So some minhagim appear in the Gemara, right? We have a chapter in Masechet Psachim about Makom Shenagu, a place that has a custom. We have Tosefta in Psachim and in Moed Katan that discusses all kinds of customs they had. And throughout the Talmud, we have customs. But there are really a few types of customs. There's a custom which is Devarim Amutarim, something that is technically permitted halachically, V'achirim Nagu Be'emisur. Some people have the custom to say it's prohibited. Let's take an example. We just had Chanukah. So we lit Hanukkah candles, and everyone knows that on Hanukkah you're allowed to do all the work you'd like because Hanukkah is not a holiday in the Torah. The rabbis who instituted Hanukkah did not prohibit any work on Hanukkah, so I'm allowed to work as much as I want. But there is a minhag. The ladies have a custom not to do work while the first half hour that the candles are lit. Where did that come from? That's devarim amutarim. It's really permissible. You're allowed to do work then. The achirim and some other people, nagu b'emisur, have the custom to treat it as prohibited. Yesterday was Rosh Chodesh, right? On Rosh Chodesh, there's no prohibition from doing labor. Yet many women have the custom that they don't do laundry on Rosh Chodesh. Certain menial tasks they won't do on Rosh Chodesh. Why is that a minhag? It's, again, it falls under this category. Devarim amutarim, it's something permissible. And the custom evolved that we treat it as prohibited. They used to have a custom that two brothers wouldn't go into the mikveh together. One would wait outside, his brother would finish, then he would go inside. They used to have a custom that there were certain benches that the sellers and the workers would sit on. And you wouldn't go to those benches on Shabbos. So you could say, maybe they didn't want to look like you were doing business on Shabbos. But again, is there a prohibition to sit on a bench on Shabbos? No, but there's a custom. So we have the first type of custom, which is maybe the most classical custom we meet, is this type of custom, where technically there's no prohibition, but over years the custom evolved to treat it as prohibited. So that's one type of custom. Then we have other types of customs. We have customs that connect to prohibitions. We know there's a part of an animal called the gida nashe, right, that we don't eat. But the custom is that we take out all kinds of fats that are really permissible, that are right next to the gida nashe, and we don't eat those either. So there was a concern. If you eat this, you'll end up eating that. So there are customs that are not only dvarim and mutarim, they're permissible, but nagube misu, they are customs that evolved in order to ensure you don't end up doing what's more prohibited. So there are more examples to that. Let's talk about kitniot for a second. So in Shulchan Aruch, it says what we all know, that chametz is only made from the five grains, right? Chita, sora, kusemet, shibol, chual, shifon, we have five grains, and only those five grains can become chametz. Okay, so then what's the problem with eating rice? So I know some of you are Sephardim, you'll tell me, no problem, I enjoy rice on Pesach, good for you. And I'll let my daughter marry your son and there's no problem. I have no problem if my son-in-law eats rice, not in my house, on Pesach. I don't, right? I have no problem with it. Meaning, and I'll tell my daughter, enjoy, right? If my daughter marries a Sephardi, she says she's marrying a Dutchman. Okay. She says, I want to wait 1 hour to say that. But if she marries a Sephardi, so she should go eat rice and enjoy on Pesach, no problem. They're wonderful kosher Jews, those Jews that eat rice. But why don't I eat rice on Pesach? Why don't Ashkenazim eat kitniot on Pesach? So there are different explanations. We're going to go with one explanation, which is quoted in the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. It's an important explanation because it's also relevant today. There's a food called chilbe. Don't ask me what it is, I don't know. But I know that it's some kind of kitniot that Yemenites like to eat. Well, you know that when chilbe grows, it's almost impossible to have it growing without wheat growing among the chilbe. And the Rabbanut publicized a year or two ago, that you shouldn't buy chilbe, even if it says that the chilbe was checked 3 times, even Sfardim shouldn't buy chilbe, because the Rabbanut checked the chilbe that was checked 3 times and has a kashrut for Pesach, and you know what? They found chametz inside. A number of years ago, Rav Machput Spice Factory that sells spices that are kitniyot, kosher for Passover, that have excellent oversight. Rav Machput is a good hechsher. They say, chametz mixed into their spices. So the first explanation of why we... Now, I don't know as far as the chametz, but that's what I heard, that the spices of Rav Machput from a number of years ago, there was a time that suddenly they found that on the run, things weren't as clean as they should have been for Pesach. So it seems that for sure in the days of Chazal, and we see from the Rabbanut, they put out a letter. Again, Rabbanut, I quote, because they try to be very lenient. So you shouldn't think I'm quoting some far-out, stringent party here. We're quoting the Rabbanut, whose goal is that if something's legitimately kosher, leave it kosher without extra stringencies. And the Rabbanut publicized a list of the different legumes, the different kitniyot, that you can find wheat or other chametz grains mixed in. So this is one explanation as to why Ashkenazim don't eat kitniyot, because what we've discovered, I had a picture last year, someone sent me mixed into their rice, or their chulent beans, one or the other, they found kernels of wheat. It seems that when you grow one item, it's practically impossible to have a one-item field. And we would think that if I'm only growing, let's say, barley kidney beans, if I'm only growing that, or I'm only harvesting that, then my field should be clean with that. No. It seems still today we cannot do that. I'm not even talking about the assembly lines where they process these, that they process wheat on the same assembly lines. I'm talking about the growth. And what we've discovered is, till today, there are certain foods that we cannot get perfectly clean. So, coming back to the custom, we wanted to understand minagim, customs. Some minagim are a minhag that were instituted by the leaders of the time or the leaders of a community out of recognition that if we don't stop this, then there'll be a real problem. And here, I want to digress to a story. Okay? We have an institution from the days of the Geonim that when a woman goes to mikvah, she keeps it quiet. She doesn't tell anyone. The Geonim said, it's immodest. Everyone knows that the night a woman goes to mikvah, there's a mitzvah for her and her husband to be intimate. So it's immodest to talk about it. So the Geonim made a cherem. No one should tell on the night she's going to mikvah. Fine. The Ramah, the story goes, became rabbi in a city. And one morning, he sees the gabbai go over to a person and say, Mazel Tov. The guy says, thank you, and leaves you. The Ramah asks the gabbai, why'd you just tell him Mazel Tov? So he says, last night his wife went to mikvah. The Ramah says, what? So he says, yeah. So the Ramah says, and how do you know? So the gabbai says, my wife is in charge of the mikvah. And our custom in this town is that every woman that goes to mikvah at night, I come in the morning and I tell the husband, Mazel Tov, that's our minhag. So the Ramah heard this, and he wasn't pleased. So he said to the gabbai, end the minhag. Okay, I'm the rabbi here. Stop the minhag. No more saying Mazel Tov. Okay? Fine. A week passes. 2 weeks pass, and the Ramah is standing in shul, and one day he overhears the following conversation. A man walks over to the gabbai and says, why didn't you tell me Mazel Tov this morning? So the gabbai says, listen, the rabbi told me to stop this custom, so I couldn't tell you Mazel Tov because the rabbi told me not to, but I'll tell you the truth. My wife, she is still in charge of the mikvah, and she still reports to me every night who's going to the mikvah. Your wife didn't go to mikvah last night. The Ramah stopped in his tracks, and he started thinking. And he said, okay, in this city, in deep Poland, it is freezing cold. It must be that the women, as pious as they are, they have a very big fear of dunking without clothing in the freezing cold water. And it must be that a rabbi a long time ago figured out that if the women don't know that there's another level of oversight, that her husband will find out if she did or didn't go down, then they'll cheat sometimes. Cheating means that the husband transgressed an Isser Kares. So the Ramah realized, hey, this is against the Gaonim's institution, but maybe the rabbi, whoever it was, decades or centuries ago, instituted this here because it's so hard to dunk. Can you guys imagine getting unclothed and going down in freezing cold water? So they needed another level of oversight. And the Ramah realized he made a mistake. He reinstituted the custom. And the story goes that the Ramah realized from there how careful we have to be with minagim. You see, minag, it seems far out. What's going on here? Why should anyone know other than the man and his wife when she went to mikveh? Answer, under these circumstances, it was important. So when we see a minhag, we have to be very careful. We're not quick to say nonsense. We say maybe there's something else going on here. Let's find out more. Let's understand what's going on here. So we have a second type of minhag. We have a minhag which was instituted by leaders of a community, and we're not sure why, or we are sure why. It's there to protect because of certain needs of that community. And there are minhagim that are different. And sometimes people come and tell me minhagim, and they're very upset by the minhag. And years later, I understand, I learn what the minhag really was. I can tell you an example. You guys will get very annoyed, so I won't tell you. But there's a minhag that students here told me about, which initially I didn't understand, and then a student came and explained it to me. At least I understood what was going on. Should I tell you? But you have to promise me not to get annoyed at me, okay? Right. So students showed up and told me, in a certain country, that there was a minhag not to give converts an aliyah, not to allow gerim to go up to the Torah. And there was a certain, and not to marry converts either. Two different customs. So when I heard it, my initial thought was, this is amaratzut. This is against the Torah. The Torah says you're supposed to love a convert more than a regular Jew. So that was my first thought, but I kept quiet. I didn't say anything. After a decade, a student came from one of these countries and told me why. I said, "Why?" I didn't say anything. He said, I converted in this country, and I'll tell you why this country has this custom. Why? He said, in this country, the difference between Christians and Jews is not big. He said, what's happened in that country is that there are many people who want to be very, very conservative. And they look at the church, and they're very disenchanted. And so you have people who want a lifestyle that's conservative and modest and lives according to an ethical system, and they connect to the Bible, and they want that lifestyle. But they don't believe in Judaism. And so in this country, there's a huge temptation. He said, in this country, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who want to convert to Judaism, and not because they really believe in it, but because they really want that lifestyle. So he also answered another thing to me. In that country, they make people wait a long, 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 long time before they can enter a conversion process. Longer than I heard of any other country. And he explained to me why. He said to me, I have many friends. He himself was a convert. And he said to me, I have many, many, many friends who want to convert to Judaism. But they don't want to convert because they believe in it. They want to convert because they're very disenchanted with the system of the church. And they want a different system that'll give them a system, but they don't believe any different than they believed earlier. They still believe in the New Testament. They still believe in many things. Only they want the Jewish system. And so he said to me, that's why in this community, they have called them these sanctions, so that a person won't feel like, I can join this community and I'll get all the perks. They know if you want to join the community, you're going to have to leave this country. You'll have to go to somewhere else where you'll be accepted as a convert. And then he said, when people hear that, so then many of the Christians who don't believe in it, they take a step back. They don't undertake the course. So he at least explained to me, because when I first heard it, it seemed like against the Torah. Why would you make a sanction? The Torah, I'm not saying right or wrong, I didn't make this custom. But at least this person came and explained to me something which, when I first heard it, I said, my first question was, is there a rabbi there? I said, is there anyone there that learned Torah? Is there anyone there that allowed this custom to take place? How could it be? So that's, yeah.
Why do the Syrians still accept converts?
I don't want to go into every custom. I'm saying it's a
general thing.
Right. I don't know. I could answer, but I'd rather say I don't know because I never researched it. I can guess. Look, we have a rule. Tosfos quotes, Rabbeinu Tam quotes the following rule. He says you have to know that the words minhag are the same letters as gehinom. He says you cannot just take something as a minhag. This is in the laws of Gittin. There was a custom that would disqualify a get. And people said, but that's the custom, that's how we write a get. And so in the Rush, it's quoted from Tosfos, that you can't just take a minhag and say, I go with it blindly, that's the custom, goodbye, minhag. No, Tosfos says, it's not in our Tosfos, but it's the commentaries of Tosfos that write, you have to remember that minhag is the letters gehinom, perdition, and a minhag is only qualified if it had the oversight of rabbinic authorities. If there were rabbis who saw the minhag being instituted and approved it, if it's a community that had a rabbi leading it, then you could say, I respect the minhag. But just because people wake up one day and they do something, so now it becomes a minhag? No. It has to be ratified. It has to be that you know it's coming from a source that has rabbinic oversight. These are the two principles in Tosfos. Okay. There's a third concept of minhag, and that's the one that addresses Gilad's question. I want to deal with that in 1 minute. I just want to order our pizza, and we'll get to it in 1 second. You asked, why can't I switch minhagim? Why can't I switch 6 hours to 1 hour? We'll get to that in a minute. Now we're up to the third type of minhag. So, the third type of minhag is where we have two legitimate opinions. Let's take, you have the Rambam, you have the Tosfos. We just learned about whether you wait 6 hours, like the Rambam and the Rifrei, or Tosfos, you're going to wait 1 hour between meat and milk. We discussed switching the tablecloth, ending the meal. Fine, Tosfos, how it evolves in the Ramah. Am I going to wait 1 hour like Tosfos or 6 hours like the Rambam and the Rif? Okay? Two opinions, two legitimate opinions in Halacha. Can I put back food on the plata that's liquid or not on Shabbat? Two opinions. Is it enough when I leave food from Friday going into Shabbat that it should be cooked halfway, or does it have to be fully cooked, etc.? So we have many areas in Halacha where there are two legitimate opinions, or more. And you look at the communities, how do we light Hanukkah candles, right? Sephardim have one person lighting all their candles, the father of the house lights the candles. Ashkenazim, everyone lights their own Hanukkiah. Two legitimate opinions in Halacha. But you see that communities adopted a specific opinion in Halacha. That's a type of minhag which is far more binding than all the other minhagim. Because if our community, the Ashkenazim, took on the Ramah, then I cannot wake up one morning and say, I want to go Shulchan Aruch, leave me alone Ramah, I'm going to go Shulchan Aruch, I want to become a Rambamist, I'm going to be like a Rambam today. I can't do that. Because our community, the Ashkenazi community, accepted the opinion of the Ramah. So when we have two legitimate opinions in Halacha and a community went with a specific opinion, there I can't change. I can't say, you know, I'm going to go with a different opinion. So with other minhagim, a person can say, I want to change a minhag, and we view a minhag, you asked how is a minhag binding? So it breaks down to two things. Number one, we have the pasuk, Al titosh torati mecha, don't leave what your mother taught you, which is, from there we learn the concept of it's not only about what your father teaches you, the written Torah, there's also what your mother teaches you, which is how we behave, which is things which you won't find in writing. That's what we call a minhag. So we're supposed to keep a minhag, but what if I want to switch minhagim? So there are many times where you could do a tarat nidarim, you'll ask your Rav, but there are many times where you could say, I'm going to take three people and annul a vow, and with that I could switch minhagim. So on certain minhagim you can do that. But when it comes to a minhag that's not about whether I'm going to work on Rosh Chodesh or not as a woman, or work when the candles are lit, the Hanukkah candles or not, rather it's a minhag of which opinion do I take halachically, there I can't go on and all that vow. That's binding for me so long as I'm a part of this community. There are things that the community does that I'm obligated to. I can't wake up one morning and say, I live in Egypt. And everyone in Egypt goes like the Shulchan Aruch or the Rambam, wherever. And now I'm going to do different. I live in Syria. The Syrian Jews all went with Shulchan Aruch. So now I'm going to go and annul the vow and do like the Ramah. By what right? I'm obligated by the community. It's like a vow that I cannot undo. So the third type of minhag is more stringent that way. That when we're part of a community where our tradition is to go with a certain opinion in halacha, I cannot wake up one morning and annul that minhag and go with a different opinion. However, I could move. Meaning, if a Jew moves to a Sephardi country, then he gets all the minhagim of the Sephardim. Meaning, the minhag is binding when I'm a part of this community. So, if an Ashkenazi Jew would move to Egypt back in the day when in Egypt you had a good, strong community and they all went like the Shulchan Aruch, then that Ashkenazi Jew would adopt the customs of the Egyptian Jews. And that's what he's chayav to do. And if you still have a vibrant community in Holland, I don't know if you do, so there's a community that has their customs. If I would move to Holland, so then I would get the Dutch customs and I would only wait 1 hour between meat and milk. Meaning minhag is defined by my community, this type of minhag. So our minhagim are very much defined by community. They're defined by tradition, assuming I stay within the community. But a Sephardi that would move to a completely Ashkenazi community would not be allowed to eat kitniyot anymore. An Ashkenazi that moves to a Sephardi community would be allowed to eat kitniyot. Today, in Israel, in the United States, in many countries, you have many communities. Thank you. There are many countries where right here. You have an Ashkenazi minyan here on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, and the next room has a Sephardi minyan. You go next door, you have within the same building the Ashkenazi shul, Oel Yitzchak, and next door the Sephardi, and one flight up the Sephardi. You come to our shul in Kochav Yaakov in the same building. You walk into the main hallway. On your right side is the Ashkenazi shul. On your left side is the Sephardi shul. And upstairs is the Yemenite shul. Down the block is the Moroccan shul. Okay, so what are you going to say? I'm in the Kochav Yaakov community. I get the Kochav Yaakov minhag. There is no Kochav Yaakov minhag. There is no Kiryat Moshe minhag, Jerusalem minhag. In Jerusalem, you have all the minhagim. You have whole communities that moved. And so today, in many places, there is no one minhag. So you can't say, I moved to Kiryat Moshe, so now I adopt the Kiryat Moshe minhagim. There are no Kiryat Moshe minhagim. Yeah, so that's where we do not have a set minhag. Today, Baruch Hashem, in Israel, we have so many communities and whole communities that moved, so they retain their minhagim, and so we've become heterogeneous here. Originally, things were more homogeneous. Within a tribe, you had set customs. Within a city, you had set customs. Today, it's not that way, and it's a blessing. It's a blessing that we're not that way. So now comes the question, okay, a person is supposed to retain the customs of his forefathers. So a person came and asked me a question, something in the laws of Yom Kippur. He should wear a kittel, he shouldn't wear a kittel. So I said to him, do what your father does. So he said to me, my father eats pork on Yom Kippur. So I said, don't do what your father does, right? He was asking me about wearing a kittel on Yom Kippur. Ashkenazim wear a kittel, Sephardim do not. So I didn't know that his father doesn't observe Yom Kippur. So now, what are you going to tell him? What custom should he do? So there are two opinions here. Rav Shlomo Zalman held that when a person is chozer b'tshuva, not ger, chozer b'tshuva, he goes back to the customs of his forefathers. He'll research, he'll find out where his grandfather, great-grandfather came from, he'll go with that. Or, if he's in a yeshiva that has a custom, he'll take the minagim of the Rosh Yeshiva. That's what Rav Shlomo Zalman held. Rav Feinstein says that you get to choose. Once the minhag's been broken, and you don't have a set community, like here in Jerusalem, or in New York, or in Brooklyn, you have so many communities. There's no one community, right? You have four shuls within a half a mile radius of your house, with four different customs. So what obligates you? Nothing obligates you. So then you get to choose. Rav Feinstein held that when a person is chozer b'tshuva, and there's been a break in their customs, they get to choose. And the same would go for a convert. That a convert gets to choose. However, buyer beware. There are two stages. Stage number one, you're still studying. You don't know. You don't yet know the difference between minagim. You ask the average chozer b'tshuva convert, what's the difference between Sephardi and Ashkenazi? They'll tell you in the Sidur. Wrong. That's a very minor difference between Sephardim and Ashkenazim. That's one of the most minor differences between Sephardi and Ashkenazi. The major differences lie in many areas of halacha. So right now, if you were to choose between Sephardi, Ashkenazi, etc., you don't know. And whether you'll daven as a Sephard or Ashkenaz or Ari or whatever, that's not the main point. It's something you'll choose over time. The main point is what customs you'll take on, which will affect everything you do. From your Seder to your Shabbos to your davening to everything. So you don't yet know enough. So at this point, you can just go with the flow. However, it is highly recommended that you do choose a custom and go with it all the way. You should not start doing this like this and that like that, because you won't know where you're contradicting yourself. Meaning sometimes in two areas of halakha that seem disjointed, really, if you're going to go with this opinion here, then you have to go with that opinion in something completely different in halakha. And our customs have to have consistency. So the correct thing for a person to do is at some point to choose a custom. I'm not taking questions yet. However, in a minute, when you choose a custom, it's recommended you choose a custom in adherence with one of a few things, and ideally all of them. If you're going to get married soon, so it would be good to do it with your wife, if you can wait that long. Sometimes a person converts and he's only going to get married in 4 or 5 years. He can't really wait that long. Number two, you should go with the custom that you have a Rav who can guide you on. There's once a guy here who converted and he wanted to go with the custom of a city that was destroyed somewhere in Europe. There was only one Rav who knew the customs of that city, and that Rav was in his 80s. It didn't make a lot of sense, but he knew his family came from that city. He wanted to go with those customs. But then he had to go and research in archives what were those customs. Until today, he's not clear what he should do. And I can't help him. It's recommended that you choose a custom within a range that you could find a rabbi that will guide you, and ideally connect to that rabbi before you make the move. And finally, when you make the decision, which could be a little bit down the road, you don't have to make it right away. You know, while you're here, you could go with Machon Meir. Go all the way with it. Don't start mixing and matching. You should go all the way. And I know it's tempting as a convert to start mix and match. I'll wait 1 hour like the Dutch. I'll put back soup on the platter like the Rambam. I mix and match. I'll do slichot from Rosh Chodesh like the Sfaradim. But then on Yom Kippur, the Ashkenazi tunes speak more to me. Don't do that. You don't want your kids and your family to be all messed up. Your kids have to know this is my custom, this is what I do, all the way, and choose a path and go with it. I'm saying, okay, so those are three pointers on choosing Minagim, and I think they're very practical and correct pointers. I don't know who was first between the two of you. Okay? Alon.
Let's say you were really into it and then you got married and your wife would expect for you to eat the pita fish with chowder.
It's not a custom. There's no problem for a Sephardi to eat gefilte fish. There's nothing wrong with it.
No, I'm saying she's a good Jewish mother.
I don't think there's a custom that obligates her eating gefilte fish on Shabbos. I don't think that falls under the heading of a custom. I don't think so. That is a custom. That is Sephardi or Ashkenazi. So our assumption is that when a wife gets married, she takes on her husband's customs on many things, not all things. There are things that are her own personal thing, like lighting Shabbos candles, like dunking in the mikvah. Some women dunk 3 times, some 7. Does she take on your minhag? No, she does what her mother taught her. How many candles does she light Friday night? She does what her mother taught her. So there are minagim that don't really pertain to you, even though you'll say they're the Shabbos candles in my house. Right, but that goes her line, whatever her mother did. What nusach does she daven? Does she have to adopt your custom? So many would say no. That's her own thing, her tefillah. She does what her parents did. It could get confusing, you know. Your kids grow up one way and she does the other way. Okay. If you wait 3 hours between meat and milk, does that affect her? That depends who you ask. Not so clear that affects her, how long she waits. So in general, women take on their husband's minagim. Rabbi Feinstein held that it's an automatic thing, that it's like switching countries. Rabbi Avram Shapiro Zatzal, he said the Jerusalem custom is that a woman, before she gets married, annuls her vows. And she's annulling the customs in order to adopt her husband's custom. He didn't like Rabbi Feinstein's responsa. Moshe Feinstein writes, he didn't like this response. So when I quoted it to him once, I asked him about a wife changing customs. I said, you know, Rabbi Feinstein writes in his book, in Negros Moshe, that a woman getting married is like switching countries. So he looked at me and said, your house is its own country? He didn't like that. He said, you think your wife just moved into your house? So that's it? She switched countries? She's in... No, that's not... Your house isn't a country on its own. He didn't like that that line of reasoning. He said the custom is that she annuls her vows. He, yeah.
Especially in our case, your wife is allowed to say, look, you are not born Jewish, I'm not born Jewish, I have this birth, this custom,
no.
And you say, okay, but I don't know where you must have
Your custom is a custom. Once you accept it, that's your custom. No different than anyone else. Sometimes what converts choose to do, which if it doesn't take too long is sometimes a very good idea, is to take on their wife's custom because it makes it much easier. Meaning she knows her custom, and if you have questions, you could ask her father. So that's a very good convenience if you have that option. But sometimes a convert's going to take another 5 years to get married. It's not so simple to just postpone accepting a custom. You know, 1 year, 2 years makes sense. This Rabbi Feinstein told me. He said the first year or two after conversion, a person can say, I'm still learning the customs. But after that, it's already complicated to say, I'm not taking any custom, I'm still learning. Just a second, he was waiting first. I'll get to you in a second. Yeah.
If a girl lives in a country, I take my friend's example. I live in Holland. And long before I converted, maybe 10 years, I have the Ashkenazi minhag. Is that a minhag?
No. What a person practices before conversion is practice. It's not a minhag. The fact that a person practiced for 10 years being Ashkenazi and then they converted and decided to be Sephardi, that's fine. Everything they did beforehand is not binding. It's just practice. Yes, good evening, Daniel.
A question and a comment. Iran, there came a big portion of Jews 500 years ago from Poland. Shouldn't
they
be
Ashkenazi? They should. It's a good question why they aren't. I didn't know they aren't. The question is, did they come in one at a time, or did they come as a community? When individuals come in, so we have a concept in Halacha, we say, Kama, Kama, Batel. Everyone that comes in, so two Ashkenazim move to Iran, they adopt Iranian custom. A month later, another five Ashkenazim move in, they adapt the Iranian custom. It could be in the course of 5 years, you'll end up having 50 or 100 Ashkenazim there. But each one that moved in as an individual. So then they adopt the customs of the place. If you have 500 people moving at a shot, so then you say, okay, a community moved, they retain their customs. The question is how they migrated. Whether it was an organized migration or one by one came in and became a part of the community, I don't know.
They have more European mentality, don't have a Middle Eastern mentality. They don't understand.